Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, April 29th. It's almost May.
Yeah, and it is cold.
My name is Magnus Teevil. Joining me in the studio here is
Peter R.H.
And Stephen Fan's going to join us a little later with his arts report. We got some good stuff on the show today. We have Gardening with Embark, some more tips on keeping your garden green. Peter's going to be, what are you going to be talking about
this
week,
you know,
Peter?
What? I'm going to admit I made an error. This was a.
You make errors?
Okay. No, but actually, I'm trying my best to be factual. And then it was something that I did a while back, and I kept delaying saying I did. Actually, what it is that Hillary Clinton supposedly was not part of trying to stop as Secretary of State in 2009, getting 37 cents to 61 cents.
All right, well,
the minimum wage. And I got a, but then I got stuff about the Clinton Foundation today.
Okay. Excellent.
And I'll just say a bit of why I made that error, too.
Okay. Cool. Well, we'll talk about that in a little bit, Clinton Foundation and some other stuff there. One of the big news items in the news this week has been spreading campus protests at universities and colleges across the United States. They've been doing sit-ins and camp-ins at a number of campuses, starting in I believe it was Columbia University in New York City, and often getting a really, really strong reaction from authorities and campus authorities, which has mystified me a bit. I'm not sure why. You know, it's one of those things when with a protest like that, if you roll in heavy and try and force it out, all you do is make the protest stronger. And I wonder what's at the... and we've seen the evidence of that. You know, at Columbia, they rolled in and tried to drag people away. There were some arrests. You know, there's insistence that they take their tents down and go somewhere else. And, of course, that completely plays into the protesters' playbook by drawing more attention to their protests, which is kind of the whole point of a protest, is to get attention about your issue. Those protests have since spread to numerous other campuses across the United States, all the way to from New York City through to the West Coast, and this weekend a protest camp was started up at McGill University. All these camps are protesting what's going on in Gaza, the current war in Gaza, and the actions of the Israeli government and the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, but all of them also more specifically are making more local demands, and that particularly is demands that their universities divest themselves from any of their investments that are in defense industries and other industries that are supporting the actions in Gaza through selling items or selling military gear or all that other stuff. And probably, you know, protests have been happening and protests and rallies have been happening around the world on a weekly basis since October 7th, since this latest war started. There is one in downtown Vancouver just this Saturday, or no, Friday night. I saw it making its way through downtown with chants and quite a good crowd. But these protests have definitely seemed to have caught the attention in a particular way. And now that we've seen one happen in here in Canada now at McGill, I think we can pretty much expect to see more of them happening across the country. Protests like this that are successful in getting the attention to the issue that the protesters want to see do have a way of spreading quickly. In the previous show, Guerrilla Radio, they're talking about the Occupy Wall Street protests from the time of the economic crash of 2008 and the period after that, and those protests had a similar arc of protests starting in New York City. It's not always, these things don't always start in New York City, but it happens to be a coincidence this time, and getting a lot of attention and very quickly spreading to many other cities and locations, including here in Vancouver. There was an extended Occupy protest happening down on Georgia Street at the Art Gallery, on the plaza, Georgia side plaza of the Art Gallery, for quite a long time. And I think we're going to see the same thing happening here. I think it's probably only a matter of time before, and probably I'm going to make a prediction, and I'm going to guess that sometime this week it's going to happen here at SFU or UBC.
Well, maybe. Now, it's funny that both sides are complaining. Like the people that are kind of taking the side of Israel, like Rebel News, Ezra Levant, he'll say something, and the police don't do anything about the protesters, and he's a Jewish person, by the way, in case you don't know. He's saying that that the police are taking the protester side, and it's interesting that when you hear both are sort of, I mean, I'm not saying who's right or wrong as such, but it's funny that both feel victimized very much if you hear their side. But I think the other issue is, like, how do you, I think that they're not handling the Columbia University protests right. I mean, I would say that. But it's funny still that both sides are very unhappy with how they're being portrayed in the media.
Well, that tends to be a particular factor or part of this issue. And you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has always had that strong, divisive factor in it, where each side tends to take a, there's a real difference in opinion between the two sides, and often each side doesn't really see the legitimacy of the other side's position.
Right, yeah.
You know, whereas, and in fact, both sides tend to see themselves as quite righteous in their,
in their
opinions, which, you know, means they feel very strongly about what they think and believe, and often utterly or mostly reject what the other side is saying.
Well, I want to add something here. I was, prior to the October 7th of 2023, I was going to a Palestinian kind of meetings prior to it. And I kind of stopped going to them because it's getting a bit hairy now, you know. But I have heard, like, their side in a very decisive way. I think one thing I think is bad about I don't like that from the river to the sea. I mean, that's a bit going a bit too far. I mean, I'm not saying that every time they say it, it's really they really mean it. But I think that. And that they've been saying, I don't know what its exact phraseology, Magnus, from the river to, I get the
mountains. Yeah, from the river to the sea.
And I think that's a bit wrong to say it. I mean, what I think is going to hopefully happen is the illegal settlements have got to stop.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, that is something that it's and the thing is that even under Israeli law, they're illegal. But they've gotten support from the Israeli government. I think this this really has to stop. And the thing about Rebel News, prior to October 7th, they went over to Israel, And they were, and that they had like one of the reporters far away from the region of the illegal settlements. And they said, oh, there's we don't see anything wrong happening here, but you're about 10 miles away from it shooting a camera. I mean, kind of obvious. I mean, as I say, it's funny how both sides can sort of get their victimization. But I think hopefully that's going to be ending. I mean, because it's kind of ridiculous. It really, I think.
I don't see the prospect of that happening soon, though.
Well,
the settlements and, you know, the expansion of the settlement seems to be ongoing. I wanted to jump back just for a moment to the idea of the, and we'll come back to the settlements of the, you know, what makes people uncomfortable about the, you know, the chant from the river to the sea, because what that references is the Jordan River, which represents kind of the eastern border of Israel-Palestine, and then, of course, through to the sea. And many people interpret that statement to mean that a free Palestine would involve the elimination of Israel, which sort of seems to be what it is saying in terms of, you know, what that slogan could represent. I'm sure if we had, you know, someone from the cause here, they could offer some various interpretations. But, you know, at the flip side, you have the Israeli government, the current Israeli government, which seems to be rejecting the idea of a two-state solution.
Well, they got it. I don't know. At some level, I guess that's going to be what's going to happen at some point, I would think.
It's hard to imagine how there could be any resolution without a two-state solution. So, you know, on the one hand, you have pro-Palestinian protesters, you know, chanting from the river to the sea, which seems to imply the elimination of Israel. And at the same time, you have the current Israeli government and some of the more extreme parties in the governing coalition and, the current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, rejecting the idea of a two-state solution, which also seems to reject any option for an independent Palestinian state. So, I mean, both sides in their rhetoric, saying, you know, basically stating a position that are fundamentally incompatible, both with each other, but also with what would seem to be any realistic resolution to the issue. Now, I don't want to make it suggest that, you know, like a both sides are even here, because, I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, from a military and security standpoint, you know, the Israeli state and the Israeli government have the huge upper hand.
Yeah,
they're the ones who have the capacity to act or not act. In big ways. Obviously, you know, a group like Hamas also has the ability to act because they did, you know, the October 7th attack, which was certainly brutal and murderous and very ugly. But, you know, one big difference is that the Israelis have the capacity militarily to crush the Palestinian people if they choose to, whereas Hamas has the ability to harass and kill and murder, but they don't actually really represent an existential threat to the Israeli state.
Well, I would agree. Well, I would as such agree with that, but wasn't that that attack on October 7th quite, I mean, divorcing it from what Israel's done, it was sort of not a good for them. For Israel, that an initial attack.
No,
it was a. Okay. I think that the term existential threat is a bit. I mean, it kind of. It's not the original existentialism.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about that attack, and then the subsequent Israeli invasion of Gaza. Is one thing I've read a bunch when all this first started up back in October and has kind of been lost in the subsequent flow of events, was that one of the things that enabled Hamas to make that attack was that Israeli security forces had been shifted from that zone where the attack happened over to the West Bank, partly in support of Israeli settlement activity, of the settlement activity in the West Bank, so that the normal sort of security forces in the region where the attack took place, which is sort of down in southern Israel, had been really thinned out in a way that made the zone vulnerable. And when you think about it, you know, think about a fairly substantial number of Hamas fighters crossed the border and were able to operate in Israel pretty much without interruption for several hours before significant IDF forces were able to respond to the incursion. And you think about how Israel has, I mean, these kind of threats are always present in the zone, and the fact that, as you know, border areas could have been that vulnerable really speaks to a failure of their security response. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, I think there are many, but one of the reasons Netanyahu just keeps pushing forward on this, because at some point when all this is over or stopped, it's not going to be over, but when, you know, the current phase of hostilities ends, attention is going to turn back to how did this happen in the first place. And I think it's going to look very bad for the governing coalition, which Netanyahu and the other people in charge, because in some ways, you know, they made choices that left those folks vulnerable to attack in a way that probably should never have happened. I mean, it never should have been possible for like 1,000 or so, I think that was the number I heard, or several hundred fighters to cross the border and roam around in Israeli communities for a significant period of time before there's any response.
Oh, was that West Bank, when they were going to the West Bank, was that about illegal settlements or supporting them?
It was, from my understanding, it was a bit of both, because of course when there's when they're pushing towards different, to create new settlements, there's going to be some pushback from Palestinians. And it's a while ago since I read this, so I want to be careful I don't get it wrong, but you know, they were over there, they shifted a bunch of forces from that border region over to the West Bank as a sort of indirect support, because of course if there's lots of forces around while militant Israeli settlers are occupying hilltops and destroying Palestinian structures, which often is the first phase in establishing a new settlement, you know, next thing that you know, they built some temporary structures and they, you know, they keep occupied, build some more permanent structures, and next thing you know, their occupation settlement of that specific bit of land is sort of happening, and it sort of goes from there. And they'd shifted a bunch of security forces over there to deal with that, but not to deal with
Illegal settlers.
No, not to deal with the illegal settlers, but to deal with the understandably hostile Palestinian response. It's like you hear about some of the stuff happening in the West Bank with extremist settlers, you know, attacking and harassing Palestinians in the West Bank. And some of the stuff they do sounds pretty much like terrorism to me. I mean, people are getting shot. People are running around, you know, civilians, settlers are, you know, running around with guns and doing activities which could easily be interpreted to be like kind of terroristic activity. But, you know, it's the Palestinians who end up getting arrested and sent to jail.
Well, the thing is, I think Israel is looking less favorable more and more, mm-hmm. I think, because for example, the 1967 war and the 1973, the United States was more concerned about the Vietnam conflict. They weren't really focused. Now we got world attention really focused on this at this point in a way that they haven't had it previously. So they have to deal with that. And I don't know. You're kind of right that it's, I mean, you can sort of say, well, there's a bit on this side, this side. But what you said earlier was about it, the Israeli side is the more one was the might at this point. So anyway, I don't, yeah. Hopefully it'll, something, I don't know. The other thing is, can they get, they want to get rid of Hamas. Are they succeeding in this? It doesn't seem they're succeeding.
No, I mean, it's hard to say whether that's even possible, right? I mean, you know, groups like Hamas, you know, have a way of, when it comes to the sort of final showdown, so to speak, a bit to sort of just melt away. You know, they bury their arms and fade into the population and you know, go to ground, as it were, until things settle down. Or at some point, you know, presumably the Israelis will have to withdraw from Gaza. And then they'll come back. You know, maybe some other political entity will be put in charge of it. But that happened before. And, you know, Hamas rose up and sort of launched effectively a coup and a military takeover of the entire territory and has been, you know, the ruling authority ever since, right? And now they're being pushed aside. So we'll see. I mean, it's not like just sort of an ordinary military defeat, right? Because the whole arrangement is sort of asymmetrical. You know, Israel, you know, when they're fighting Israel, you know, in this current war, it's not like they have a real expectation that they're going to be able to hold off and resist, hold a line of territory and resist the Israeli forces. They know they're going to be pushed back. They know they're going to lose. You know, they knew when they launched the October 7th attack that there would be a big Israeli response. I have no idea whether they expected the response to be what has in fact happened, but they knew there was going to be a substantial response and that a lot of people were going to be killed.
Well, one school of thought about this is that the Palestinian people become very desperate, and it's like they don't have anything. Some of the population feel they don't have anything to lose, and it comes out of that kind of desperation about what happened. Not all of them. I mean, some. You know, it's funny when you look at overall. There's been stories about Palestinian people welcoming Israeli soldiers to look over because they wanted to look over. So there's been, it's just been desperation. I think that's part of the problem, just the desperation of the Palestinian people. That's sort of one thing also. Over the years, I've gone to various things on the Palestinian issue. And one thing that was interesting they brought up was that there's more per capita water in the Israeli side than in the Palestinian side. Mm-hmm. And sometimes Palestinians will look over like a chlorinate. When you chlorinate water, you can't drink it, right? So they'll look over like an Israeli swimming pool, a chlorinated swimming pool, and they're not having that much water on their side. That's sort of an example of sort of what they have dealt with over the years. So anyway.
All right. Well, thanks for that conversation. I'm just going to jump back to my prediction that I think there will be some sort of protest camp set up here or at UBC or maybe both within a very short time. And I guess we'll talk to those folks if they appear here, and we'll see what the response of of SFU. As I say, you know, there's already one happening at McGill University with tents, and they've taken over, you know, a large quad. And we'll see what happens here.
Okay.
All right. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name's Magnus. With me is
Peter R.H.
Peter's going to be back. We're going to be both back in just a moment to talk about...
Error I made, but also what the Clinton Foundation. There's been some controversies over the years about the Clinton Foundation. So I'm going to say what I... said wrong about Hillary Clinton, then we're going to talk about the Hillary Clinton Foundation a bit.
All right, we'll be back in just a couple of moments.
This is Bird Note. If the early bird gets the worm, then the early birder gets the birds, right? Morning is a great time for birding. Songbirds begin their chorus just before dawn, and many species start looking for food at first light. But not everyone is willing or able to get up at the crack of dawn. And that's okay. It's not the only time to experience birds. Singing often continues throughout the morning. And some species, like American robins, keep the show going until sunset. High noon is a great time to see daytime predators like hawks on the hunt for small mammals. Or cormorants in the water diving for fish. As sunset draws near, watch for birds that become active in the twilight, like common nighthawks sweeping the sky for insects. And if you're a night owl, well, look and listen for real owls. They're wide awake at midnight. So if you miss the sunrise, don't worry. The day is long, and birds are all around us. For Bird Note, I'm Jonice Franklin.
Subliminal duets? Absolutely not. The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Metal Meltdown. This show's been going for a long time here, here at CJSF. Worth checking out with Dr. Mysterio in the chair every Monday night. Well, Monday evening, coming to you. All right. So, Peter.
Okay. So the error I made was that what I said. This was when I was doing the thing about the Haiti, with the UN peacekeepers in Haiti. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, from 2004 to 2007. Yeah. And actually, it was a bit challenging. It was I wasn't able to see what I had seen like 20 years ago. It was a Marxist group had actual footage of what was happening, and I wasn't able to. I mean, at that time. And so I was kind of a challenge to get the information and so on. Now, what happened was that it wound up being in 2009, it was a comedian. Some comedian had stated that Hillary Clinton was against the a Haiti minimum wage going from 24 cents to 61 cents. Now, what it was that the U.S. Embassy in Haiti was actually actively against it. So I made an error about that. And I guess I have to not, you have to sort of understand what a source, I have to go to the proper sources and so on at times. And anyway, so there you go. But now there's only one thing. Well, I thought There has been